dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. When Sinatra hosted The Tonight Show, he booked me to do a stand-up, which you can go to John Barber's World, my site, and see. That was in the late 70s. Someone said at the time, I believe it was Ernie Kovacs, comedian Ernie Kovacs, said television was like a steak. They called it a medium because it was never well done. America's best television critic at the time, Gary Deeb, who wrote for the Chicago Tribune, said, television is the only business in America where competition does not improve the product. Now, that's when there were three networks, just three. Now there are over 500, and it's more straws in the same septic tank. Now, two huge changes have occurred since then. First, those old enough, like myself, who might remember those great quiz shows of the late 50s, like the $64,000 question, when it was discovered that the number one show in America was rigged, the public was so outraged they held congressional hearings and nearly every quiz show on the air was canceled. Today, we have known, admitted liars delivering the news to us. The most blatant, of course, being Bill O'Reilly. O'Reilly wrote two books. One, Killing Kennedy. Another, Killing Christ. His next should be Killing Truth. That would be the only one that would be honest. Second, television really has become filthy. Not just cable, commercial. A friend of mine, Richard Dawson, hosted the original Family Feud in Los Angeles. The new version is taped in Atlanta, and it's hosted by a black comedian named Steve Harvey. And let me tell you, I am no prude, and I am certainly no saint, but this show, a lot of it, is absolutely disgusting. It's a family show only if you're catering to the Manson family. Over the weekend, I accidentally saw part of an episode. And this is just one of the questionable questions to a family which included children. The question was, quote, what is it that you wipe immediately after you use it, unquote. If you're thinking my behind, you got the correct answer, believe it or not, but everything in America is getting like that. America's not only dumbing down its people, it's dumbing down its politicians. The thing that I found most repugnant recently, though, on television, was Congress's reaction to Israel's Netanyahu. This entire week, Netanyahu must have been at his proctologist having hundreds of lips removed. So to explain this, and to bring some sense and some sanity into John Barber's world, I've asked the world's most prominent, most articulate Middle East peace activist to return for a while to interpret for us what Netanyahu's appearance and reception were all about. He's a former Marine and a current army of one-man truth. His name is Ken O'Keefe. Ken, thank you again for doing, as Clint Eastwood would say, making my day. Thanks for being here. Or is it day there?
Well, it's the middle of the night now. It's midnight. And thank you again, John. It is a pleasure, and nothing but love and respect for you.
I couldn't wait to talk to you again after his appearance. Were you in America at the time he appeared before Congress?
No. I'm in London, and I've not even watched the whole thing, but I've seen it all before. And at the end of the day, we can take the same messages from this appearance as the last one. But I think more importantly than that is the absolute reality that more and more Americans, including the dormant patriots, are having to face the fact that the country has been hijacked, and literally, it's in your face.
What do you think Netanyahu initiated this appearance because he's running for office in Israel, or did John Boehner take it on his own just because he wanted to irritate Obama?
Well, you know, for me, these people are only puppets, and they only really read the script. So Netanyahu is nothing but a puppet who's carrying out reading out the script. So, you know, it's all very entertaining if you take it for real. But behind those puppets are the real powers, and the agenda for them is anything to maintain the system. So they've done an exemplary job of trying to create an idea that there is antagonism between Barack Obama and Netanyahu, and I find it quite amusing that anybody would seriously subscribe to that, because these people do not have any independent policy at all. They are puppets, literally. And Netanyahu, while he's an arrogant, brash, really annoying war criminal prick, quite frankly, to put it in simple terms, he is nothing but a reflection of the policy of the powers behind him. That's all he is.
Who are the powers behind him?
Well, there's no doubt at all. And we can argue till the end of time about the specifics of who is in charge. And there are many people with many different ideas on this. But the one single thing that we can all identify as having the most worth in terms of power in this world is the financial system. It's the money that is used to create scarcity amongst the masses and abundance, obscene abundance. In fact, a supply of infinity. It's not about the money. Those that run the world have all the money. They literally can produce as much money as they want, and there is no oversight because they own the courts, they own the governments, they own the police, they own the media, they own everything of every worth in terms of their power, so they're not worried about it, and they use finance. We can argue about what's behind that, and I do believe for sure there are many layers behind that, but the vehicle that is used is finance. If the people take back the power to print their own money in their own nations, and backed by a non-usury, transparent policy of real investment in the real economy, every nation in the world can have a very, very prosperous existence. They can liberate themselves from the insanity of a banking system which is intended to enslave humanity. We can literally free ourselves by printing our own money. And the last, you know, the man that you made such a beautiful film about, The Last Word, on the JFK assassination, John F. Kennedy was the last man to, the last president to have any honor and integrity, if you ask me. He issued those U.S. notes that were backed by silver, that were non-Federal Reserve notes. That was as much his death sentence as anything else he did.
Yeah, that was Executive Order, I believe, 11110, which is still in existence. And the second he was shot, they stopped the printing presses on that. And the same thing happened to Abraham Lincoln. Was told that they would lend him money at 30% interest, and he decided to print his own greenbacks. But Ken, when you speak up against Netanyahu, I'm sure that you are attacked frequently as being an anti-Semite. Do you ever hear from Jews, average Jews, or even prominent Jews who are on your side in your criticism of the Zionist government in Israel and Netanyahu?
Well, I've definitely had more than one communication from Jewish people who appreciate what I have to say, and I know Jewish people whom I respect deeply. The bottom line, however, though, is it really does kind of define, or it really depends on how you define Jewish. It is not as clear-cut as it might seem, but a Jewish person who believes in the supremacy of Jewish people or chosenness, I have a problem with that. I have a problem with anybody who has that kind of supremacist ideology. So if we mean by Jew people who believe that they are above, superior, chosen, and the rest of us are not, I have a problem with every single person, whether they call themselves Zionist or anti-Zionist, makes no difference to me. The bottom line is I'm against supremacy in all forms, especially when it's combined with the kind of power that Israel wields. And this is simply undeniable. I mean, that little country, if we're to believe the Hollywood production that's put in front of us, is in charge of the United States. But the truth is that Israel is nothing but a favorite plaything of the powers behind the scenes. And it's made to look like Israel is control. And the Jewish people are being sold out as well. So ironically, I'm not actually an enemy to the Jewish people. In fact, I would say that if they really truly subscribe to a supremacist ideology and that's what they believe in, then fine, stand by Israel and continue on the course you're on. But I would also say that is about as stupid and self-destructive as you get. Best to change course fast. If you genuinely believe you're better than everybody else, well, God help you when everyone else figures it out, because it ain't going to continue.
The last time Israel tried to level Gaza, I never saw on American news any of the anti-Zionist demonstrations led by hundreds and hundreds of Jews. I only saw it on the internet. I mean, there were hundreds in New York and in Chicago and Los Angeles marching down the street holding up these anti-Zionist placards. Never saw it. The only place I actually saw it was on a site called If Americans Knew. Do you know about that site? Have you ever written for them or appeared with the lady who owns it, a Jew who owns it?
Yeah, Alison Weir, I'm not mistaken. They put out a lot of extremely valuable information, and I tap into all sorts of sources of information, and they're amongst them. But they're also more of a mainstream kind of appealing more to a mainstream, and institutions like that will, for their own reasons, and I'm not in any way condemning it, keep me at arm's length, as it were. I speak far too frankly for any organization that seeks to appeal to the broader spectrum.
I don't
take it personally. I honestly don't. I look at the work of If Americans Knew and a lot of other groups or individuals who I don't necessarily agree with on all things, but I see a lot of important, valuable information from many sources that I don't agree with. But I'm wise enough to be able to really see the truth for what it is. Make sure you keep hold of that and let go of all the rubbish in between.
Well, when that happened, that last barrage on Gaza, I was totally offended by Harry Reid, who's our representative here in Nevada. And I sat down and wrote and taped an open letter to Harry Reid. It got 8,000 hits in just a few weeks. And basically, I was talking about the dangers of having dual citizens, Israeli Americans holding such prominent offices here in the United States. And I sent it twice to Ms. Weir to post on her site, and I never got back a response. And I couldn't understand it because everything in it was factual and probably not as radical as outspoken sounding as some of the stuff that you say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there you have it. And all honesty, I don't mean this in any kind of false or patronizing way. I respect the message that such institutions are carrying out, even if they are literally controlled opposition. Much of the information that is being published, keeping in mind that all of the most important and powerful lies are mostly true. It's the misdirection, it's the innuendo, it's the implication, it's the omission that is the most dangerous of all. And that's always a minority mixed with a majority of truth. So again, you have to be wise enough to see the rubbish for what it is and see the truth for what it is. So
when Netanyahu spoke before, he championed Bush is going to war with Iraq, which Bush did, and it was obviously probably planned long beforehand. Now he's trumpeting about going to war with Iran. Now, where do you think his speech will lead us to.
Well, I think it's all very necessarily coming to a head. You know, the American people at some point, you have to really shed the notion that it's other forces that are in control of your country and actually take control of your country. It is necessary that the American people do this. No one else can do it for them. The House is a filthy mess of corruption and treason. And if you don't restore the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights to its full place as the supreme law of the land, then really you have no one but yourself to blame for your country and your empire disintegrating into absolute chaos. And I think, honestly, that the powers that be are quite happy to transition their power to the European army, which is now being talked about, NATO, and other assets around the world who they also control. They've always been willing to sacrifice those things which are previously valuable but no longer of worth. A perfect example of that would be Saddam Hussein, who was our best friend and ally through all of his worst crimes. In fact, the CIA helped him as he was murdering Iranians, gassing them, and the Kurds as well. And that was all perfectly fine. But then he extended his utility. The same thing can be applied to the United States. It's a bigger entity, and it is a bigger sacrifice. But the empire, in true terms, the real powers that be, will sacrifice America, and are. You can see that through the policies of the puppets who are reading a completely self-destructive script.
On the internet, you can find a picture of Donald Rumsfeld shaking Saddam's hand when they signed a contract for the U.S. to supply the gas, which he used to murder the Kurds. But Saddam announced that he was going to dispense with selling his oil and trading oil in American currency. He was going to use the euro to do that. And then, yes, like Gaddafi, who decided to go on to the gold standard, he suddenly became an enemy that we had to dispense with.
Yeah, and the thing is, not to confuse Saddam Hussein for who he was, he was a son of a bitch. And a complete traitor to his people, to Islam, you know, a complete turncoat puppet of the West who carried out the will of the West in retaliation for Iran having the audacity of shedding our puppet in the Shah. He basically, I think I've lost you, have I?
No, not at all.
Saddam Hussein was used as the attack dog to punish Iran for having the audacity to get rid of the Shah. And he did all of these horrendous things.
Yeah, excuse me. What most Americans don't know, because they're too young and they're not taught it in history classes, that Iran had a democratically elected school teacher named Mossadegh, who didn't like the contract that Iran, his country, had with British Petroleum, and decided that they needed a more equitable share and tore up the contract. Mm. And John... Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles went to Eisenhower and said, the guy's a commie, we got to get rid of him. And now the CIA brags on their site and in public how they were able to change regimes, a democratically elected regime, the same thing that they did with Salvador Allende in Chile when he wanted to nationalize Nixon's Pepsi-Cola and IT&T. They admitted murdering him. And yet these people still walk around. George Bush, Cheney, Colin Powell, for crying out loud, and Condoleezza Rice, who was my favorite golf course in Atlanta, the Masters, she's made a member of that course, and they are literally war criminals. Pardon me, I didn't mean to get started on that. But have you ever heard of a writer named Ben Hecht?
I don't know that I have, actually.
Well, if you have a pencil and paper handy, two things you should write down. One is called A Child of the Century. Ben Hecht was the highest paid screenwriter in Hollywood. He wrote Gone with the Wind in 12 days and never read the book. When Zanuck had scrapped the movie and wanted it rewritten, all Hecht could get was a 30-page outline, and that's what he wrote the screenplay from. And Ben Hecht became the first propagandist for the State of Israel. Born in Racine, Wisconsin, he didn't realize he was Jewish until Hitler wrote Mein Kampf. And Hecht, on his own, over the objections of the studio heads, who were all Jewish except for Spiro Skouras at Fox, raised millions of dollars. They bought a boat. They called the Hecht. They had 1,000 Jewish volunteers and arms sail to Tel Aviv, to the port, to help the Israeli freedom fighters gain complete freedom from England. But Ben-Gurion had made a deal with the British to be the first prime minister, and Ben-Gurion had his troops sink the Ben Hecht with 1,000 Jewish souls on it into the ocean. He blessed those guns, became the first prime minister, and those guns can be seen at an Israeli museum. Ben Hecht then said that Ben-Gurion had become the Nazis that had created them in the first place. So that book, and then there's a book called Perfidy about a doctor named Kastner who was very prominent in Israel in the 50s. Ben Hecht discovered that he was a Jew, a prominent Jew in Israel, who helped send thousands of poor Jews to the death camps and to the labor camps. And in exposing that story, the government of Israel tried to suppress it. But the trial finally took place, but Kastner was never executed for his crimes. Anyway, that book is called Perfidy, and I didn't mean to go off on the side. And I only became a reluctant learner of this because I was such a fan of Ben Hecht, because I was such a fan of movies. And in getting this material, this is what I learned. So if you ever have a chance, Ken, the book is called Perfidy, and his autobiography, which has wonderful stories, is called A Child of the Century. Anyway, I didn't mean to get sidetracked about that. But evidently the same thing happened to who was the professor that said that the Holocaust was an industry for Israel and some Jews, Zionists in America?
You know? That's Norman Finkelstein said that. Yeah, that's his book.
Have you ever talked to Norman?
Yeah, I've had an email exchange with Norman, and we've expressed respect for each other's views. But once again, Norman is someone who definitely doesn't appreciate my candor with regard to Jewish power. So, you know, again, I don't like to speak. I really, you know, in all honesty, I mean, it's so easy to sit here in judgment of others, and I'm not going to try and sugarcoat what my disagreements with other people, but what I'd rather do is focus on the things that genuinely we can see are true. I disagree with some really great people on minority of issues, but I will always respect and appreciate the wisdom that they share, even if they're compromised in other areas. And for me, actually, the litmus test is 9/11. So when you get down to it in terms of truth, if you don't speak the truth about publicly available information about what really happened on that day, then you're not a serious truth teller in my book. But at the same time, I can still take fantastic information and will continue to take great information from people who are dead wrong on that subject.
When you say that Finkelstein didn't applaud your views on Jewish power, there is a famous Jewish columnist for the Los Angeles Times that a year and a half ago wrote a whole page column on the power of Jews controlling the media in America, the cinema in Hollywood, and he was proud of it, and I guess justifiably proud of it, and he hoped that it would continue forever. A question, yeah. And you can Google that and you can find it easily. A question that I have, and it's only popped up a couple of times. The reason, supposedly, the Jews are so anti-Muslim or anti-Quran is that the Quran preaches that there should not be the lending of money at interest. Is that true?
Well, it's quite ironic, actually, because when you think of all the Christians out there who have been thoroughly conned into supporting a Jewish supremacist Zionist state of Israel that's committing all sorts of abominations and is the ultimate criminal state, actually, if a true Christian recalls Jesus Christ got rather disturbed by the moneylenders in the temple and actually got a bit physical. And clearly, Christianity from the beginning made clear that usury is amongst the worst of crimes, perhaps even the worst, and I would argue that is actually the case. So Islam and Christianity are very consistent on this and other the most important issues. But Judaism does differ, or at least as it's practiced, that is for sure, it differs profoundly. And this is a, you know, I really feel for any group of people who would try and use usury to enslave people, because eventually the people will figure it out. And if it's not too late, you know, God help you, literally.
Well, I lost an $800,000 an $800,000 house on a golf course a few years ago because of that. We had my wife and I had borrowed a few thousand dollars from American Express, and we always, and the interest rate at the time was like 8%, and we always sent the payment on time. And then after about 2 years of making payments, my wife said to me, because she did them, she said, "Why isn't this going down?" I said, "Well, show me the last bill." The last bill showed we owed a small fortune. So I called American Express and asked them what had happened. And they said, "We were a day late on one payment. The interest went, get this, Ken, to 31%. And I said, "That's usury. You people should be in prison." I said, "It wasn't us. It was the post office who failed to mail it on time." And they said, "No, it's when we receive it." I said, "Did we pay a fine, a late fee?" And they said, "Yes, you paid a late fee." I said, "Okay, could you reduce it back to the 8% that it was 3 years ago?" She said, "No, I went through three supervisors who all said it stays at 31%. I took my American Express card. I burned it in half. And I sent it back to the CEO of American Express, who had the same name as the guy that owned the Flying Tigers airline. I can't remember his name offhand. And I told him that he was fortunate that his building was brick. Otherwise, it would be in the same condition as this card. So I have been subject to that myself. But, you know, and I was in the 1% at one time. Now I'm sort of middle class, upper middle class, but I see it all around me. And what I see is, last week, everybody in the news was standing and applauding and cheering Obama because supposedly unemployment was down in America to only 5%, the best since 2008 when the recession or depression hit us. But I must tell you, I travel around the country. It has got to be a whole lot more than 5%.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those statistics, it's like gold and silver and oil and all the commodities that we're really subject to and really affected by. It's all completely controlled. They own it. They can turn it up or down. Silver and gold, especially silver, is amazing. I mean, you look at the actual supply. It violates all supply and demand principles.
There have been some people Skyping us, but I'm not getting any of the Skype messages that people want to ask you. So I'm sorry. I am sort of I'm not a computer geek. I'm sort of computer challenged. But the bottom line, Ken, comes down to this. You have Israel with well over 100 or 200 nuclear weapons. They sentenced one of their scientists to prison and locked him up for 10 or 15 years in solitary confinement for going public with this knowledge. The bottom line is, since the beginning of man, we've used every weapon that we've ever developed, all the way from the slingshot with David and Goliath to Nagasaki and Hiroshima. They didn't even have to drop the bomb in Nagasaki, but look at what they've developed since. Do you think these weapons will be used, and will Iran have anything to do with being a target of it?
Well, it's really impossible to say whether or not a nuclear exchange or a nuclear Armageddon is going to occur. But one thing is very certain. The powers that be are completely drunk on their own power. They also have the means financially to create underground cities, and they have produced these cities at the cost of trillions. And they are crazy enough to do their best to instigate a third world war and meanwhile go underground while the rest of us suck on it. And if that ain't something to be aware of and concerned about, then I don't know what is, really.
Then the last question would be, you said earlier that we should be held to blame for our failing democracy. But when I was growing up in the late 30s and in the 40s and the 50s, there were great unions. There were great advocates. We have Social Security in this country today, which the Republicans are trying to privatize because it was based on Norman Thomas, who was a presidential socialist candidate in the teens. It came from him. FDR instituted it in order to save capitalism, as it were. But it seems that the unions have been destroyed. All of these groups that seem to be groups that could change the country have been destroyed, and their leaders, from John Kennedy to Robert Kennedy to Malcolm X to Martin Luther King, they've all been gunned down, and we all know that they were gunned down by the American government or the American military. So how on earth can you blame us as private individuals for letting democracy fail when there's no way that I could see of, maybe there's a way that you could see of, how we could regain it, how we could regain control over our own country?
Well, you know, very shortly, the bottom line is the United States is blessed with the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. It is supposedly the supreme law of the land. It seems obvious to me that every American patriot must insist that the U.S. Constitution is restored to its proper place. All laws that contradict the U.S. Constitution should be declared null and void, and everyone who has defied their oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution should be arrested and charged with treason in many cases.
Well, I have to concur with you, but George Bush is reputed to have said it's just a goddamn piece of paper when he was talking about the Constitution, and you can see it's being abrogated all the time. Look at the problem that Chris Hedges has had. I mean, he's probably the most articulate political critic we have in the country, and he has taken the American government to court because of laws that allow the government to arrest and hold people like you and me and anybody else who talks like this without habeas corpus and without a lawyer indefinitely. And he has lost that case. So that means it becomes the law of the land. Naomi Wolf wrote a wonderful column last month. She was almost crying. You could almost see the tears in the typewriter over what had happened with that case. So I must tell you, I would love to be active somehow, but I don't know how. I don't know who to vote for.
I can understand, you know, I can understand the frustration, but, you know, you can be frustrated and you can bitch and you can moan, but at the end of the day, there is a solution. And it's, you know, the United States, the people of the United States have a great blessing in the U.S. Constitution. No matter how much it's been defiled, there is a great blessing there. And if the American people decide to really take hold and cherish that blessing, they will get their nation back. And I would love to see each of the states have true self-determination. I don't really want a federal government any bigger than it needs to be. I'm a true conservative, quite frankly. I don't want any government in my business. I only want them dealing with those things that truly are necessary and are required to have representation for. And if they don't represent the U.S. Constitution and their obligations to the people, then they should be removed immediately.
Well, it seems to me, Ken, that in school today, the children all the children all the way from kindergarten up to college probably see more about the Ten Commandments, which are frequently not adhered to by most Christians, than they do about the Constitution, which it seems to be diminishing in interest in this country. I mean, the state of Texas is now going to rule out Darwinism and suggest books that say that the world is only, you know, a few hundred years old or a few thousand years old. So anyway, I just love talking to you, and I love reading all the stuff that you write, and I look forward to it again. And I'm going to send you an email again outlining Ben Heck's books, and if you want, I'll send them to you as a gift also. And again, I really appreciate you being on the show, and more than that, I appreciate you being alive still. Thanks, Ken.
Well, thank you, brother. Thank you. Respect and love to you always, and I'll hopefully be on the show many more times to come.
Yes, you will. As a matter of fact, one night I may let you host it and take it over. You have better things to say than I do. Thank you so much again, Ken. Have a wonderful Tuesday.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Now the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
I'd like to thank George Knapp, the best host of Coast to Coast, for that terrific unsolicited review of our documentary, The Last Word in the Assassination. You can get it at Amazon as well as read dozens of other terrific unsolicited reviews, some from some very famous people. Also, while you're out there, for just a couple of bucks, you might want to pick up John Barber's Uncensored Facebook Volume 1 with a terrific intro by Richard Belzer. You can open it any place, I promise, and find something that'll make you laugh or think or get angry. It's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone. Anyway, every morning I wake up to coffee and News Vandal, the very best daily blog newsletter out there. The author is a freelance journalist, published historian, radio host, co-host, documentary filmmaker, The Warning, which I'm going to look at tomorrow. He's worked at NewsHour, C-SPAN, ABC, has won a couple of local Emmys in the Washington area. His weekly show, Inside the Headlines with News Vandal, he co-hosts with James Moore, and it airs every Friday on KRUU-FM in Fairfield, Iowa. And I must tell you, this journalist should be the real host of Money Talk. Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show. Thanks so much. And I'm sorry if we had some technical difficulties, but you know from knowing me that I know nothing about computers.
Oh, who cares about computers? Let's talk about unemployment. Isn't that what everybody wants to talk about, John? You asked Ken O'Keefe, you know, you remarked about the unemployment rate. How could it be 5.5%? Well, let's just go get right into it. How could it be 5.5%? Well, here's the interesting thing. When they released these much touted unemployment numbers at the end of last week, they pointed out that there were 96,000 newly employed individuals, but yet 274,000 people dropped off of the unemployment rolls. Okay, so 274,000 people no longer unemployed, but only 96,000 newly employed individuals.
Joe, quick question though. If these people are no longer employed or employable or looking for work, how do they live?
Well, this is the thing. First of all, on the unemployment number, they just disappear. They just go away. And if you are no longer this is kind of the oddity of the situation we're in, and I think this is why the economy continues to be the number one issue here in the United States and around the world. Even though there's a lot of talk about the recovery, there's a lot of talk about declining unemployment rate, everybody knows that the unemployment rate is bogus. It's not real. The real number is actually workforce participation rate. And in terms of workforce participation, that's the number of working age Americans who are actually working in the workforce. We now have 98.9 million working age Americans not employed.
Oh my God, but how do they live? I mean,
you have a lot of them. One of the things that's driving this are two things. One is you have severe underemployment. And in terms of workforce participation rate, the 98.9 million also includes people who are maybe working part-time jobs and want a full-time job, or working job-to-job, or working under the table, working as contractors. They can't get full-time employment. They can barely make ends meet. A lot of them can't make ends meet, and they're using credit cards to make up the difference. There was a very interesting number that came out a couple weeks ago. 36% of Americans have more credit card debt and outstanding consumer debt than they have savings. And 37% of Americans actually only have a total of $1,000 in assets. That would be in terms of savings and investments, $1,000 to their name. Everything else is basically part of the debt cycle. And it's
then why on every news channel, every anchor person, that was like the lead story on about 10 of the major newscasts. They must know that this is bogus. Why are they reading it?
Well, I listened to the start of the show when you talked about the good old days of broadcasting. You mentioned Bill O'Reilly, and you know we have Brian Williams there at NBC. One, some of them are probably disingenuous and lying and know, but I think a lot of people actually don't know better. They just go with the official BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, numbers that come out. The unemployment rate is declining. Everybody says, claps their hands and says, hooray, we have a recovery. And everybody wants to believe in good news. You want good news. We want to believe it's getting better. But you have to dig and you have to learn and you have to know something about how economic statistics are put together by the Bureau of Labor Standards. And you have to know about workforce participation rate and the fact that the workforce participation rate is the lowest it's been since 1978. And you remember 1978, John. What was the economy like in 1978?
Well, for me, it was terrific.
Well, for you, because you were at a hit show. But for most Americans, they were at the beginning of what was called stagflation.
It was horrible. As a matter of fact, to tell you how bad it was, when we started real people, one of the first things that happened was the executive producer, because of what was going on in the economy and in Los Angeles, brought in a couple of policemen who sat down everyone who was employed on the show to explain how to protect themselves in case the offices were rushed by the unemployed. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was like a scene out of a Charlie Chaplin talkie. But it was true. And they put up steel doors front and back. And that was in late 78, 79.
Well, you know what the difference between now and then is that now the unemployed, the underemployed, people who have dropped out of the workforce, they're no longer working. Again, that's another reason why unemployment numbers go down is people just stop looking. And if you stop looking and you are not getting an unemployment check because your benefits run out, you are no longer officially unemployed. Also, the baby boomers are retiring, so you have people dropping out of the workforce as a part of natural attrition.
Hang on. I'm going to interrupt you just a second. Please forgive me. We know then, okay, that this 5.8% is fake. If that is fake, then if you extend this to the stock exchange,
yes,
it seems to me that the bubble that the stock market and the Dow Jones seems to be reporting climbing all the time, that also has to be fake.
Well, John, there's a reason why it's called a bull market. Trust me. And it has nothing to do with that statue they have out there in front of the stock exchange. A series of charts that I stumbled upon.
That would be funny. You know what? Showing that somebody should do that. You know, you're bright enough to do that because you know how to work a computer. Put a giant piece of bull excrement.
Yeah, a cow
on
pie.
The floor behind the bull and call it underneath the bullshit market.
That's what it is. Like, you know, even there, you just go to, you know, they love charts and numbers, and it's very simple. The S&P 500, Standard & Poor's 500, S&P, that is an index. And what an index does, like the S&P 500, is it gives you a barometer of market performance that is based on sort of the tried, true, and trusted companies and stocks. So you take 500 of these companies and you measure them against, how about reality? Well, the S&P 500, we're at year number six of a bull market. The S&P 500 has been up, and you look at the trend line on the graph, the S&P is going up. Real GDP, you just take what the gross domestic product is, you get it down to the basic, the real GDP, it's going down, the S&P is going up. How about retail sales going down, but the S&P is going up? How about average hourly wage of production workers? It's either down or flat over the last 6 years. It modulates. Sometimes it's flat. Sometimes it drops a little bit. S&P going up when you compare it. How about after-tax corporate profits? After-tax corporate profits dropped in 2013 and 2014, but the S&P 500 went up. That is, to me, it's the S&P versus reality. It's the stock market versus reality. And I got a number for you, John. It's $199 trillion. What do you think that number is?
I haven't the foggiest idea.
$199 trillion is the total global debt. If you take all the debt of everybody in the world, all the governments and all the people, all the individuals, it's $199 trillion. That amount is actually almost three times global domestic product, the global GDP. If you take all the GDPs, you put them together, there is 286% more debt than there is GDP. And if you just think about debt, you know, old style loan making, back in 1978, one of the reasons why people were really suffering, they couldn't go out and run themselves up into debt to try and modulate their living situations. But
I think interest at that time was around 19 to 20%.
Where at the beginning of the Reagan administration, it got up that high. And here's the interesting thing about interest rates. And I went back over the last few days because I've been thinking about this a lot and looking at how interest rates have modulated over time. You know, we're right now, the Fed has been threatening to raise interest rates. And every time Janet Yellen even sort of coughs, raise it, raise it, the entire stock market goes crazy. They cannot afford to have interest rates raised. It's now at 0.25%. But there were times the highest it got during the Clinton administration was about 6%. And that led to that low of an interest rate actually led to the tech bubble. And the tech bubble turned into a giant scam. A lot of people lost their 401ks. Interest rates dropped as soon as Bush came into power, and then dropped even lower after 9/11 when President Bush said, you know, you got to go out there and shop.
Well, Joe, when you cannot repay a debt, they foreclose on you. It's either your house or your car or something. The world owes $199 trillion, which they obviously can't pay. So who forecloses on the world? What happens?
Well, and this is what I come back to, and this is a conversation you and I have had a couple times privately. The economy is not real. And I think that that's the number one takeaway from all of this, is that we are really playing with paper money. The supposed inventor of Monopoly, there's some talk maybe of the person who invented Monopoly was he died today. Apparently a feminist activist may have created Monopoly. There's some conversation there among historians. But we are in a Monopoly game. And when you have governments that print money, have a fiat currency that is tied to nothing, and you were discussing that with Ken O'Keefe in the previous segment, you basically have a situation where all of the economic activity is about moving paper around. And what has happened, the transformation of the economy from 1978 to now, you know, in 1978, part of the crisis was the United States was losing out productive capability at that time to Japan and Taiwan. Remember that? Made in Japan, and everybody was upset about Japanese cars and Sony televisions. Well, when Zenith didn't have a factory in Toledo, Ohio, and all of a sudden Sony was making stuff overseas, people were losing jobs, and the cycle of proper consumption, of what I call basic widgets 101. Bob goes to a factory in Toledo. He makes a widget. He gets a nice paycheck. On his way home, he goes and buys a couple widgets for the kids at the store. And he buys maybe perfume for his wife, and he comes home and he gives the widget toys to the kids. He gives perfume to his wife, and guess what? The perfume and the widgets were also made in the United States, and all the money is cycling around in the closed system of the United States.
But and Clinton got rid of that.
And that's, you know, when people ask me who is the worst president of my lifetime, and I say this, John, as somebody, and you know this about me, I am completely nonpartisan. I do not participate in a political party. I do not participate in political ideologies. I don't even place myself on the political spectrum. I am neither conservative nor liberal. But I will say that objectively, based on the transformation of the economy in the 90s, that Bill Clinton was probably the worst president of my lifetime. He completed the process that Reagan started, but Reagan failed at, because people forget that in 1987 we had a major stock market crash and the economy went into deep doldrums. After Reagan, when Poppy Bush took over, that economy was a mess. And if it really wasn't for Herbert Walker Bush going and attacking his former crony, Saddam Hussein, in the Middle East and playing some games with the oil market as a result of tangential games at that time, the economy would have been even worse by the time he ran for re-election and Bill Clinton ran on, it's the economy, stupid.
Well, you know, we have these crashes every so many years. So if the stock market is fake, is there going to be a crash?
I can't see how there isn't going to be an eventual crash. You have the European Central Bank. Get this. The European Central Bank's lending is actually a negative lending rate. That's their lending policy, where if you want to keep money with the ECB, you have to pay them. They don't even pay you interest. You got to pay them for money. And they're doing that to try and drive people into the marketplace to spend money, because you have deflation issues in Europe because people are not buying. In America, everybody thought that the falling gas prices was going to stoke consumption. Well, it turns out they didn't, because people are actually doing something they haven't done in a long time. They're saving money because everybody is afraid. And oh, by the way, the deer in the headlights that nobody is looking at and we are heading right toward is that China's economy is heading for a major collapse. Think of this, John. Here's a number for you. 60 million. That's the number of empty apartments right now in the Chinese real estate bubble. The Chinese are heading for a big crash, and people have always said that the Chinese own us and they control us. In a way, really, the American consumer and American corporations have controlled the Chinese, and now that American consumers cannot buy or are unwilling to buy or both, China is heading for trouble.
Two closing questions then. What can Americans do? I mean, Ken O'Keefe said to regain the country, you have to somehow implement the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which nobody seems to want to run with, at least politically. And when it comes to people and consumers and money and lack of money, they seem to be even more powerless. I mean, you say there are 98 million people who are just sort of disappeared from our economy. That's almost a third of the population.
Yep.
So what's next? How does it get better, if it ever gets better, and what do you foresee?
Well, you've got this, you know, $1+ trillion in student loan debt. Debt in America, you know, I talked about that GDP ratio, 3 to 1 global debt to GDP. In America, it's over 100% for the first time. I think that it's about debt rejection. And I hate to say this, but I think, folks, you gotta divorce yourself from your credit reports. Give up on the credit reports, because it's the debt cycle. That's how we got into the crash in 2008. Because the crash in 2008 was not about selling actual widgets. It was about the buying and selling of debt. And that's how they're making money at the top. That's why you have such wealth inequality, because debt is basically siphoning off.
Don't these people realize that the French Revolution and a lot of heads rolled because a queen said, let them eat cake, okay, when they only wanted bread. These people must realize if somehow they don't make this system more equitable, their days and their money might be limited.
Yeah, well, they talked about that at the last World Economic Forum in Davos, and you see Republicans now starting to talk about income inequality. But, John, I think you know exactly why they're able to continue to get away with it. It's called fear of terrorism and war, because war is the bait and switch, and fear is the bait and switch. If you have a choice between—
You know what, Joe? That is as fabricated as the 5% employment.
Yep.
And the stock market and the Dow Jones 1700 is this fake war on terrorists, which Gore Vidal said is non-existent. He said it's like a war on dandruff. There are no real enemies. Anyway, where can people get your wonderful News Vandal newsletter, and where can they hear you?
Well, you can go to newsvandal.com. It's spelled just as it sounds, or you can just email me at info@newsvandal.com. Put sign up in the subject line, and I'll put you on my daily mailing list. And if you go to KRUU.com, you'll find links every Friday to Inside the Headlines with the News Vandal and my great co-host James Moore there in the middle of the corn in Fairfield, Iowa. I'm in Northern California, but for some reason, my heart is in the middle of the cornfields.
Well, it's a great show you guys do, and the News Vandal is my very favorite newsletter. I read it, as I said, every morning, and I'd like you to come on intermittently. Sometimes it might be only for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes to give us one of these economic reports, because they're just wonderful to listen to, and I really appreciate your being here.
Good to be with you, John, always.
Okay. Have a wonderful night, Joe. And I'll be reading you tomorrow, and I'll be watching your documentary, The Warning, tomorrow.
Take care.
Take care. Good night.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny.